esto sigue.
Recording, so I guess we can start in 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Hello, hello, hello. Today is Monday, January 9th, 2023, and this is a special hour-long episode of Queercore. Actually, an introduction to like a 2 hour long special Queercore episode. My name is Elle Barbara. Some of you might know me as a multidisciplinary artist who's mostly dabbled in music, and I also happen to be something of a like a community worker. I've helped spearhead taking what we need, which a lot of trans feminine people in Montreal are familiar with over the last few years. And I also work for Aztec, trans health and advocacy organization in Montreal, a prominent one at that, who's been around since the 90s. And today I am accompanied by my dear colleague at Aztec, Daphne. How are you?
Hi, I'm well. How are you, Al?
I am pretty good. I have to say that I'm a bit nervous because I've hosted special episodes mostly in relation to like Transistor Radio, which is another show on CKUT in the past, but mostly touching on like racism and transphobia. And this is a subject I feel passionate about, but I'm also less familiar, or I feel like I have less language around it, but it's also very important and pressing, and that is because, I mean, the context is that Justin Trudeau, the head of the federal government, has called for a public consultation on the changes to the current laws affecting HIV non-disclosure. Some of you probably know that as it is, HIV non-disclosure is, by some measure criminalized. You'll correct me if I'm wrong.
Yes,
it is criminalized. I just don't want to say the wrong thing, you guys. Okay, it is criminalized in Canada. Allow my, sparse bimbo moments. The Barbie comes out.
The bimbos are welcome in this radio hour.
Yes! Yes, 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 absolutely. And basically, the reason why I feel so passionate about this is because, I was born in the 80s. I'm of Black Haitian descent, and I'm also like a queer trans feminine person. My queerness and femininity have always been apparent growing up. And I feel that a lot of my, family childhood trauma stems from sort of like societal hysteria around HIV and AIDS. You know, it first sort of like became news in the 80s, and people weren't quite sure, how like it arose or how it was even transmitted, if it was like airborne. And so like lots of hysteria around it. And my parents, who are, Black Caribbean Haitian immigrants, probably saw it in me that I had like a bit of, faggotry, if you'll allow the term.
Yeah.
A little faggotry going on. And so, it must have played, like, HIV and AIDS hysteria must have played in them wanting to discourage me from, being who I was. I feel that, like, I have been tremendously affected by that issue, as like a lot of people have. One of my uncles, rest in peace and power, Oswald, died of AIDS in the early 90s. I was like too young to even like understand. I didn't even attend the funeral. But like there was a time, like for the younger listeners who are like tuned in today, where like when it was a death sentence. And it no longer is the case, like the scientific community has made, and the activist, you know, community has made a lot of headways towards, you know, like destigmatizing as much as, you know, we've been able to destigmatize it, and like push, you know, the scientific community to find, you know, solutions to prolong the lives of people living with HIV. And so, yeah, this brings us here. You know, I have to be honest, I've kind of, you know, I've tried my best. Like, for a long time, I was living with a fear of HIV transmission. I remember one day my father called me, and he was like talking to like a social worker friend of his in Miami. He was living in Miami at the time, and there was like a piece of paper that was just like a bunch of papers like on the desk, and one of them said that there was a high propensity of like HIV transmission among gay black men in the United States or in Florida, something like that. And it was like, he didn't like point towards that paper specifically, but I feel that that was the reason why, that was what he wanted me to see.
Yeah.
And so I live with that fear. I live with the fear of also like being a statistic, quote unquote. Yeah, and I could say that for the longest time, I wouldn't have even considered dating someone who was living with HIV. And I have done a lot of work. I'm not saying that I'm perfect and I'm done with, like, my inner work. But I can say, I can gladly say that I would not have a problem with it anymore. And I would feel, like, totally open and, like, in love still. So I'm happy for my evolution, and I'm looking forward to evolving more. And I think that we should have this conversation today, Daphne, because, well, you're the coordinator at Aztec.
Yes.
And we work with a lot of people who live with HIV, and I'm gonna play, I mean, I know that like we said that it's like Barbie hour, bimbo hour. I'm not saying that I'm gonna dumb it down because I don't want to insult anyone tuning in today, but like I'm gonna try to challenge you, so to speak, or like to make the conversation as dynamic as possible, to come from the perspective of someone who isn't as knowledgeable, who doesn't have a lot of information on HIV and the disclosure or non-disclosure thereof, to like better accompany people. Because like the thing is, those consultations are underway, and so the federal government has published like a list of questions that like you can go online and answer, and they want to know, you know, what shape, what form the laws in relation to HIV non-disclosure could take in the near future. And so I'll ask you, Daphne, to like kind of like talk about yourself, say whatever you want to say about like your professional trajectory, and to talk a bit more, give more a bit more context on those HIV consultations.
Thank you, Elle, and also thank you for sharing your parcours, your journey in understanding the stigma that has clearly, you know, affected you as it's affected so many people. I'll quickly say, similar story with me. My parents decided not to tell me that transgender people existed growing up because they had a suspicion that that was my desire to be transgender, and they believed that I would get HIV, I'd have a short life, my life would be full of suffering, and so they decided not to even tell me that such people existed, right? So this stigma is deep, not only deeply tied to trans history and trans experience, but it continues to shape people's understanding of trans people. And I'm speaking about trans people because, you know, Elle and I work with an organization that is by and for trans people. This Aztec has supported marginalized trans people, particularly sex workers and people living with HIV since 1998, which is actually the year that HIV criminalization was codified by the Supreme Court of Canada. So,
what does codify mean, in case anyone doesn't understand?
Well, in 1998, the Supreme Court made a decision basically saying that people living with HIV have the obligation to disclose their status to any sexual partner so long as there is a realistic possibility of bodily harm. And in the 1990s, this was understood to be almost every situation. Then in 2012, there was another Supreme Court decision that came down that gave more specific parameters for the conditions under which people living with HIV have to disclose their status to a sexual partner. And in 2012, the Supreme Court said, if you live with HIV, you have to disclose your status to a sexual partner unless you use a condom and you have a low viral load. So if you follow both of those guidelines, you don't have to disclose. Now, of course, we've reached a point in HIV science where we understand that if you use a condom, there is zero chance of transmitting the virus. We've reached a point in HIV science where we know that if you have a low viral load, that alone is enough to create zero chance. You know, we now know U equals U. If you're undetectable, HIV is untransmissible. But
hence the U equals U.
Yes.
Undetectable, untransmissible.
Yes. But the Supreme Court says, nope, you have to use both a condom and have a low viral load. Otherwise, it is illegal for you not to disclose your status.
Can you be clear on what a low viral load slash undetectable means, in case some people don't understand?
So viral load refers to the amount of virus that's in your blood at any given time. And there is like a specific threshold, like there has to be a certain number of copies in your blood for you to be considered having a low viral load. And when you're undetectable, that means that when you have your blood taken, the blood test actually can't detect the virus in your blood. That's how little virus there is in your blood.
Mm-hmm. And if it can detect it, it means that it cannot be transmitted. There's
exactly.
not enough of the virus in your blood for it to transmit to someone else.
Exactly. So that's what established HIV non-disclosure law in Canada, is these two Supreme Court decisions. But I think it's important to identify how people are actually experiencing these laws right now. Because when people are charged for HIV non-disclosure, they are charged for aggravated sexual assault, which is one of the most serious offenses in the criminal code. It's what people who engage in violent rape are charged with. And so if you're convicted of aggravated sexual assault, you are generally registered for life as a sex offender, which means you have to undergo phallometric testing. You're forced to watch violent sexual assault.
What's that? Phallometric testing. Am might be hard to explain, but like,
I mean, it's horrible. It's basically, you know, like people who are listed as sex offenders, they force them to watch these videos of violent sexual assaults, and then they like test, you know, whether you're aroused. It's like, it's just a form of social control for people who are listed as sex offenders, and it's part of like mandatory counseling that you have to go through if you're a sex offender. I mean, among various other horrible things that happen to you, like you can't live, you can't find an apartment, you know, you can't be around school, like just a ton of stuff, right? So you're listed for life as a sex offender if you're convicted of HIV non-disclosure. You are generally, it's a possibility of a lifetime in prison. And a lifetime in prison. 93% of the people convicted of this for HIV non-disclosure receive prison sentences. And the average sentence is about 4.5 years. And we've heard stories of solitary confinement, assault and harassment by guards in prison, denial of medical care and HIV medication. And as you might imagine, you know, for trans people in prison, that just brings it a whole other realm of nightmares. For migrants, people who don't have Canadian citizenship, a conviction for HIV non-disclosure means you're all but certain to be deported. And many, many people have been deported under this law. And so, you know, this isn't a hypothetical either, because 70% of cases lead to conviction. It is not common to be found innocent of HIV non-disclosure. It's an insane number of people who are found guilty and incarcerated for this, and a disproportionate number of them are Black men and Indigenous women. And several have been trans sex workers as well. So, you know, even if you're not convicted, right, if you're part of the 30% who's charged and not convicted, there are often sensationalized media stories where, you know, the media contact every ex-lover you've ever had and, like, ask them to comment on you. And, you know, you get death threats. I mean, it can ruin the rest of your life. It can prevent you from getting jobs in the future when employers Google you and they find these sensationalized accounts. Even if they're retracted later, you know, it doesn't matter. It can ruin your life. And so we see that people who have been charged with HIV non-disclosure have a high rate of PTSD and have a high incidence of suicide attempts. So there's just enormous harm that's very, very much still happening. There are people still incarcerated for HIV non-disclosure now, and Canada is one of the most punitive countries in the world for HIV non-disclosure.
Right. I just want to reel it back to Canada being one of the most punitive countries with regards to, like, in relation to HIV non-disclosure. And, like, first off, like, we both work at ASTEC, and so the community of people that we work with is not only trans, but, like, you know, is often criminalized. We work with a lot of migrants, some of whom are sex workers, many of whom have been street involved, have used drugs, and so or have had issues with like hard drugs, and so I guess like it would be fair to say that like the propensity of you know sort of like HIV them having a relation or like an experience of HIV is you know pretty high, but it's still an issue that like you know concerns like the entirety of society. And like my guess is that like those federal consultations were not triggered by you know a sudden you know wave of empathy for people that are street involved, that are sex workers, and that are migrants. how did it come to be? Why is Justin calling for a consultation on this matter?
Well, many international organizations and HIV groups and within the country have been saying for years that Canada's approach to HIV non-disclosure is incredibly punitive, severe, totally out of line with the science, reinforces stigmatization. And the Liberal government said actually several years back that they were changing their approach and that they would take into consideration new ways of dealing with this issue. But they haven't, this is the sort of moment that they're coming forth to the Canadian public and they're saying, what do you think, what should we do about this? Mm-hmm. And we'll see, well, hopefully some legislative, major legislative reform will come out of this consultation.
Right. And so people, even within the like HIV activist community have, you know, have adopted different stances on the matter, and the coalition that ASTEC forms with Stella has issued, you know, a number like of answers that could literally be copy pasted into the form that exists online, which anyone can fill out and submit until January 13th, this Friday coming. And so that link is in ASTEC's Instagram bio at ASTEQ. So Alpha Sam double T as in trans elephant question. Or if you look up Aztec's Facebook page, like it might be like it's, I think it's one of her recent, in one of her recent posts. Or
it's
like,
the most recent post, yeah. And we have the link in English and French.
Link in English and French. And so like those are like the questions in essence that like are asked, that the government asks people to answer in order to guide like a sort of like orientation on, you know, HIV matters as to whether, you know, it should be decriminalized or not. Anyone can answer those questions. And so I know that, you know, you might not feel, you know, spoken to when we say that, like, you know, there's like a public consultation. You might feel that like you have to be some sort of like, you know, legal expert or like medical expert on the matter. You have to work for an organization, but anyone who is like, you know, how did you refer to,
a stakeholder, a concerned citizen.
Concerned citizen, exactly. Concerned citizen.
No, you do not have to be an expert of any kind. They are asking the general public for their thoughts. So please, we definitely, what we want to, you know, communicate to you all today is if you feel that the criminalization of HIV is unjust, make your voice heard and take part, because it's a really important moment where things have the possibility to really change.
And it really is important, and we'll touch on like the nitty gritty in the second half of this hour long special. This hour long radio special. But truly, you guys, like, we work at ASTEC, we work with some of the more criminalized and marginalized people, who also happen to be trans, in Montreal. And so, like, we're in direct contact with, you know, experiences that, like, you might not be privy to. And we also want you to know that, like, what is at stake might affect you either directly or indirectly. So it's not just a question of like being like using like you know, illicit drugs or like doing
Well, just to touch on what you started the show with, right? You know, there's this enormous stigma that affects people living with HIV, but it also affects trans and queer people generally, because HIV is associated with transness and with queerness, right?
Yeah.
And today, one of the biggest, like, causes of the stigma toward HIV is this criminalization regime, right? So you don't have to be living with HIV or even know with someone who does to be affected by the criminalization of HIV non-disclosure. The stigma that is caused by this legal regime, it affects you too, if you're trans or queer. It helps create the environment of hatred and social exclusion that we've been seeing intensify in recent years. So I just want to make clear that this isn't a niche issue for our community. It's really not only important from a solidarity perspective, it's important for everyone.
Yeah, and even like as straight people, like we probably have some you know, cishet allies tuning in, you know, who don't identify as queer and who will realize how, you know, that may like how like these consultations could affect them in the long run depending on their outcome. And the goal is not just to walk you through some of those like questions that the government is asking, but also perhaps convince you to think differently or to open up your mind. I know that prior to, like, you know, digging deeper and talking to experts, that like I was like nowhere near where I am today. And so and as we said earlier, there are different people are positioning themselves differently in relation to HIV decriminalization itself. And so we want to make it clear that, like, there are many ways to answer, and like we're coming in with a stance that is very much of the full, like, you know, total decriminalization stance.
Yeah, we're pushing for the full decriminalization of HIV, and we'll get into the reasons why after the break.
Yes, but I get to call that break, baby, because I'm the host of the show. So,
sorry, if you're listening on your toes.
You're listening. You're listening to Queer Core, a special episode of Queer Core on CKUT 90.3 FM, and we will be back after the break. Keep it locked.
Cute.
Yeah. Hello, hello. So we are back with this special hour-long episode of Queer Core on HIV non-disclosure. I am your host today, L. Barbara, with my dear colleague at ASTEC, Daphne Barile. For those who are only joining us now, the show, well, as I just said, is about HIV non-disclosure. The Government of Canada is holding a consultation on the criminalization of HIV, and they're asking anyone who feels, like, concerned by the matter to respond to an online survey by Friday, January 13th, 2023, so this Friday coming, to let the government know that, well, of course, you fully support decriminalization in every situation. And if you're not yet convinced, we'd like to walk you through it as experts on the matter. Like, we've both been working at ASTEC for years, working with the trans community, the part of the trans community that is most criminalized and at risk, whether, you know, they're street involved or sex workers or migrants, and have like a precarious immigration status. in order, and I will repeat this through and through, but in order for you fill out the online survey, you can go visit ASTTEQ's Instagram page at ASTTEQ or ASTTEQ, ASTTEQ on Facebook. It's our most recent post, and there is a link to answer those questions in French or in English, hopefully to sway the government in, you know, a full decriminalization of HIV, non-disclosure. And you don't have to be an organization. Of course, we're trying to summon all like concerned organizations in Canada, but you can also be a concerned citizen. You can be someone who lives with HIV or not. Like, you can have loved ones who live with HIV and you want to voice your concern. This is your time to get involved. And so, like, I thought we'd get into the nitty-gritty, Daphne. Like, the first six questions we have to say in the questionnaire are personal, and they are not, you were telling me earlier that they're not confidential?
No, they're not anonymous. So the consultation, if you go to the link on our pages, our social media, and you just decide, okay, I'm going to start answering the consultation, it starts out with a few personal questions, which if you answer them, they will not be anonymous. It does not ask you for your name, but it does ask you for your profession in a way that you could potentially write something that identifies you. So I just want to be clear that you do not have to answer those questions. You can skip that question. And yeah, if you're concerned about that information becoming public.
Okay. So yeah, like in case you're like, you know, a pop star, like if you're Celine Dion or something, like you might...
It might not, ruin your career to say that you support decriminalization.
But obviously not, because...
Celine, if you're listening, you should speak out.
She definitely should. And yeah, I'll make sure of it. This is 2023, you guys. So we know that, like, we're moving in the direction of supporting full decriminalization. So obviously we are kidding, you know, it is in your best interest to be open and vocal about wanting to fully decriminalize HIV in Canada. And so the questions that we will touch on within the next minutes for the second half of this hour-long special are the questions that one may not be comfortable answering themselves. You can word it however you want. Like, these are recommendations that are written out on our Facebook and on our Instagram that can literally be copy-pasted, like using like our Facebook page. Like, they're written out in a way that you can copy-paste them, or you can word them however you want. And so the first question, which is number 7, and you guys will see where I'm coming from, because I had a hard time understanding them personally. They're quite wordy. And so it goes, should the criminal code be amended to ensure that sexual assault offenses, which would continue to apply in cases involving non-consensual sexual activity, cannot be used where the only issue in the case is non-disclosure of HIV status? Could you translate that for me?
It essentially means, if you keep your HIV status confidential, but you have consensual sex with somebody, you cannot be charged with aggravated sexual assault. It's saying that you still could be charged if the sex is not consensual. But if the sex is consensual and you keep your HIV status confidential, it means that you could no longer be charged with aggravated sexual assault.
And ASTTEQ and Stella are fully in support of that. Our answer is yes. HIV non-disclosure is in no way comparable to aggravated sexual assault. It is an outrageous injustice that people living with HIV are listed as sex offenders for life and imprisoned for years because they chose to keep their HIV status confidential.
Absolutely. I mean, the fact that sexual assault is violent rape, essentially, is being equated with keeping your HIV status to yourself is just the cause of so... It just causes enormous, enormous harm.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to, like, ask you a question from a possible perspective of someone who is, like, fearful of contracting HIV, who doesn't live with HIV, who is not informed. How can you make sense of that? Like, let's say I don't want to get HIV, and if I, if it is transmitted to me, I might be so aggravated that I want there to be some sort of, like, reparation.
I would dispute the idea that sending somebody to prison is a form of reparation. I think that I think it's enough to say that HIV is the only public health problem that we treat with a criminal law.
Mm-hmm.
If someone gives you COVID and doesn't tell you that they have COVID, you can't go to the police and say that that person should be prosecuted, potentially incarcerated
mm-hmm.
for that. If someone doesn't tell you that they have syphilis, you can't go to the police and report them for that. HIV is the only public health issue that we treat this way. And the reason that we treat it this way is because of decades of transphobic and homophobic stigma that have essentially portrayed people living with HIV as malevolent criminals. And there is no reason why we should treat HIV differently from any other public health issue.
Do you attribute it to the fact that it was like a so-called death sentence back in the 80s?
Well, you could, but look, lots of illnesses are death sentences.
Such as COVID for some people.
For some people, yes. And we don't resort to the criminal law. Our public health strategy in every other situation is education and prevention. Make an environment where people are equipped to protect themselves from the possibility of contracting an illness, and where they know how the illness spreads and how they want to navigate that is ultimately up to them.
One of the major turning points in my understanding of HIV and how I decide to navigate it, and not just HIV, but like all sexually transmitted diseases, is that ultimately your health is your responsibility. And so, like, if you do not want to be transmitted like a sexually transmissible illness, well, there are ways to protect yourself. However, like, we briefly touched in our, like, sort of, like, pre-interview warm-up on the fact that it is not, it's not a leveled playing field. Access to preventative measures such as, like, PrEP, such as PEP, such as, like, condom is not equally distributed. Can you sort of, like, expand on that?
Absolutely. I mean, PrEP, which is an extremely effective form of HIV prevention.
We have to, like, divulge what, like, PrEP and PEP means.
Sure, sure. PrEP is a pill that many people take every day. Some people only take it right before they have unprotected sex, but many people take it every single day. And it essentially makes it near impossible to transmit, to contract HIV while having unprotected sex.
You can contract other sexually transmitted diseases, but not HIV.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's extremely effective. Many, many people in the queer and trans community use PrEP. You know, it's led to a reality now where many people, that's all they use as a form of protection during sex. It's simply that effective at preventing HIV that it's made people feel very comfortable. But PrEP is not universally accessible in this country. In Quebec, if you have RanQ, It costs $95 a month, which puts it out of reach for poor and many working class people. So PrEP is very much a class issue, and so is PEP. PEP is a medicine that you can take in a cycle after you think that you might have been exposed to HIV. So it's sort of like a version of the plan B for HIV, if you will. You know, you've had an experience that you're worried you might have been exposed. You can take PEP immediately after that.
For a month.
To prevent HIV from kind of taking hold in your body. And again, extremely effective if you catch it within the right window. PEP is also extremely expensive.
So we're talking of like a, 24 to four, maximum 72 hour window after potentially having been in contact with the virus, or like not knowing whether you were in contact or not. The only thing, though, is like you're saying, it's extremely inaccessible. I mean, I remember I have like a private insurance, and I remember being charged like close to $300 for it, which is ridiculous.
Totally. And I mean, it's also beyond a class issue. It's also a migrant justice issue, right? Because people who have no access to RAMQ or private insurance, a cycle of PEP can be up to $2,000. A month of PrEP can be $1,000. So, you know, ultimately, the government should be spending its resources on making it easier for people to protect themselves. I mean, condoms should be free in every pharmacy. From a medical perspective, we have extremely effective techniques for HIV prevention, and they should be freely available to everyone. And it's just an enormous injustice that the government has decided to respond to the HIV epidemic through criminalization instead of universal access to HIV prevention.
Because I feel ultimately that the government is not taking responsibility in like its public health measures, in the sense that, like, if you make, you know, PrEP or PEP or like condoms like more or less inaccessible, you know, you're putting the onus on, you're entirely putting the onus, not only are you entirely putting the onus on the population, and that includes both like Canadian citizens and non-citizens, but like you're basically not protecting them. And so, like, if, you know, there is like, should someone you know, seroconvert and contract HIV, you will not have given them, you know, all the tools that are necessary to prevent that from happening.
Absolutely.
We should move on to question number 8, because, like, you said something about, like, metadata or, like, big data that, like, sounded so 1984. And, like, you guys, it's shocking. We have to get into it. But, like, let's go through those questions first. So, okay. Question number 8. Should the criminal code be amended to limit its application to HIV non-disclosure cases in the following way? The accused must intend to transmit HIV to be held criminally liable, in addition to knowing their HIV status and that they are at risk of infecting others. That is, those who act recklessly but without intending to transmit HIV should not be held criminally liable. How can you make it so, like, how can you make it more complicated? Like, Justin, honestly, can you translate that for me, please?
Okay, a translated version of that question is, should we make it so that you can only be charged with aggravated sexual assault for HIV non-disclosure if you intend to transmit HIV to another person? So you have to want that person to get HIV, and the court has to have proof that that's what you intended in order to be prosecuted. That's what the question's about.
And Aztec and Stella's position is no. The concept of intention to transmit, which is based on a transphobic and homophobic myth, would intensify stigma, would risk being interpreted broadly by judges and would be exploited by police to target the most marginalized communities.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's important to recognize, where does this concept of intention to transmit come from? You don't hear about this with other illnesses. You don't read, like, stories in the newspaper about people intending to transmit other illnesses. The whole myth of intention to transmit comes from a pretty serious history from the 80s through the 2000s and even through the past decade of depicting people living with HIV as wanting to get everyone around them sick, as some kind of twisted, malevolent criminals. And this myth became very powerful. I think it really contributed to the stigmatization of people living with HIV throughout the AIDS crisis and in recent years. And it's if the government creates a new criminal offense that specifically names the intention to transmit HIV as some kind of specific problem, it's going to make Canadian people all over the country think that this is some kind of enormous national issue, that there are people living with HIV roaming the streets, trying to infect others, trying to harm them, and that's simply not true. In case after case after case where people have been accused of intending to transmit HIV that has been found to be false, it is not a real issue affecting the country, and it would intensify stigma toward people living with HIV to make a specific provision in the criminal code that says that, you know, people intending to transmit it are criminalized. There is no population of people intending to transmit HIV. And I also, when we say that this could be interpreted broadly by judges, that's because what does intention really mean? You know, like, intention is really, it's hard to talk about in court. What evidence would prove that you intended to transmit HIV? And we worry that this could really be up to the discretion of individual judges who, depending on whether or not they were sympathetic toward the defendant, could interpret intention very broadly. And finally, we know that, you know, any criminal provision that's based on a history of stigma is used by police to target the most marginalized communities. So, you know, if there's a provision about the intention to transmit HIV, it's not going to affect people living with HIV who are upper middle class. It's not going to affect people living with HIV who are, you know, white. It's going to disproportionately affect poor and marginalized people.
I have to say that, like, I agree with most of what you said, but, like, from a personal standpoint, so not, like, speaking on, like, behalf or, like, in line with the organization that I work for, ASTEC, says, I don't know if it can be argued, like, in a court of law that the intention to transmit is impossible. I agree that it is left to interpretation, which can be very broad and so confusing and unfair to some communities more than others. And I also think that there is no, you can't, like, broadly say that, like, a community massively intends to, like, you know, transmit a virus or a disease. But I believe that there can be, like, an isolated, you know, incident in which someone, you know, out of spite wants to transmit something, whether it's, like, COVID or HIV.
Absolutely.
Or what have
totally.
You.
But it's not criminalized in the case of COVID. It's not criminalized with pneumonia. It's not criminalized with syphilis. It's not criminalized with chlamydia.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason for that. The reason that the concept of intention to transmit is criminalized, the reason it exists in the criminal law, is because of the history of stigma, period. Mm-hmm.
And so what are you saying in relation to big data? Because, like, my impression here is that the best way to sort of, like, diminish, you know, the possibility of, like, malevolent intent, so to speak, is to tackle HIV from a public health angle, whereby, you know, by providing, tools for people to protect themselves and more information, and by, like, decriminalizing, period, someone who is malevolent might not even think to, like, malevolently, so to speak, like, transmit, you know, the disease, because, like, there is, like, it's beside the point, because it's tackled from a, like, a public health perspective, and all resources are in place for people to, you know, to protect themselves.
For sure. I mean, criminalization discourages testing, it discourages people learning about how HIV is spread, because it creates fear. And I think that,
and learning about their own status too.
Exactly. And so I think that, you know, it's a good point that, you know, if we had universal access to HIV prevention, you know, on the off chance, on the very rare occasion that, like, someone decides to try to cause harm to another person through HIV exposure, they can't cause harm to another person, mm-hmm. you know? And ultimately, like, we also have to ask ourselves, what real harm is there in a world where, you know, having HIV, you can live a long and healthy life,
exactly.
just like anyone else with the right treatment?
Yes.
You know, what harm is there? The only harm, the greatest harm, is the stigma.
Stigma. Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely. I want you to touch on, like, that big data, like,
I think the next question. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Cuz, like, that thing, you guys, sounds like a conspiracy, but it's very real and very juicy. So, question 9, should the criminal code be amended to limit its application to HIV non-disclosure cases in the following way? The accused must actually transmit HIV to be held criminally liable, that is, those who expose others to risk but do not transmit HIV should not be held criminally liable. Can you translate an answer, please?
So a translation of that question is essentially, you know, should we change the law so that you actually have to transmit the virus to be charged with aggravated sexual assault for HIV non-disclosure? Currently, you don't have to transmit it at all, and many, many people have been charged and convicted of HIV non-disclosure without ever having exposed their partner to the virus. So, our answer is no. And I can't stress enough, HIV is the only public health issue that we treat through criminalization instead of prevention. It is unjust, it comes from a history of stigma, and it perpetuates stigma. So that's the biggest, most essential reason. But what Elle was just referring to before is this really scary new reality we live in, where essentially in the past few years, the public health network has been taking biometric data from people's blood tests. Essentially, every HIV virus has its own unique DNA biometric code. And when people go and get their blood taken to ensure that they're staying healthy at the doctor, that blood is then analyzed in laboratories that are recording, without their consent, the genetic material in the HIV virus in their blood. And they're using that information to identify clusters of transmission. So essentially, they could identify in that laboratory who gave that person HIV. And we're extremely worried that if the law changes so that only people who actually transmit HIV are criminalized, we could find ourselves in a situation where if you go to the doctor and you want to get an HIV test, and you get your HIV test back and it says it's positive, that they could send your blood back to the lab, and or they could have already analyzed it, and they could make a direct match with the person who exposed you to that virus and file charges against that person without you ever knowing about it. And this could happen without you knowing that your blood is being analyzed for its genetic material. It could know without the other person knowing. It could happen without the other person knowing. And this is a really kind of scary situation that we're in. It's called molecular surveillance. And
so science, like, it is possible, you know, with, like, their science makes it possible to retrace the origin of, like, you know, of the strain of the virus that you have in your blood, so they can trace it back to an individual.
Yes, absolutely. And, I mean, we've already seen several published studies essentially using people's genetic material without their consent to identify clusters of HIV transmission in Montreal. And it's really worrying. And obviously, it's worrying in itself as a major privacy and human rights issue.
Targeting the Haitian, you were saying the Haitian community, a Haitian community of men who are having sex with men.
Yeah, there was a recent study about Haitian men having sex with men in Montreal, identifying clusters of HIV transmission and, you know, all of the biometric information that led to that study was simply taken automatically from blood samples.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the men in question never knew that.
They never consented
to
that information being shared. And, like, how do you frame that in relation to other transmissible diseases? Because, like, you were telling me earlier, you were explaining how that could, like, expand to, like, you know, all areas of public health eventually.
Well, that's that. I think that we should talk about on the next question. But yeah. I mean, absolutely. I guess the first thing I'll say is just that it comes from this attitude, right, that people are vectors of disease and they're treated like public health data points without any regard for how, you know, harvesting their data and using it could be used against them. And we're seeing that in a lot of different ways right now as big data becomes more sophisticated and criminalized people are bearing the brunt.
Mm-hmm. The reason why I wanted you to touch on, you know, the possible expansion of, you know, HIV criminalization into, like, other transmissible diseases is because, like, we're getting close to the end of the hour. And so I'm wondering if you could possibly, we won't, like, read out the last three questions because, again, you all concerned citizens who should be concerned can go to Aztec's Instagram and or Facebook and literally will not only, of course, like, read those six questions that have been answered for you in order to, like, kind of, like, give you more perspective and clarity on the matter, but you could literally copy paste what we've written out for you. We understand that everybody's busy and, like, dealing with the day to day, but, like, if you could extract anything from, like, those last three questions, what would you say?
I would say that the government seems to understand that it's hypocritical to identify HIV separately from every other public health problem and criminalize it, which is why it's asking the public, you know, should we maybe just criminalize all infectious diseases or all STIs? And I think that, you know, for many of us, this is a terrifying prospect because, you know, the harms of criminalization are enormous, and the idea of expanding that to the general population, where everyone would have to fear that if they gave somebody COVID, that potentially that person could file charges against them, you miss the court date, maybe if you're a sex worker working out of town, finding or you don't see it
not
in the
just
mail.
Sex workers, yeah.
Yeah, like you could end up breaking your court conditions, missing your court date.
Following is a previously broadcast program. What's up, everybody? It's the one and only Miss Chris. You're tuning in to Queer Core. You are tuning into Queer Core. You're, I seem to be having... But just give me 1 second.